voice of Westchester. WVOX.
Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX AM 1460. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard live streaming worldwide at WVOX.com. One can call directly to the station at 914-636-0110, but please stay germane to our topic. My guest is author and historian Dr. Ellen Chesler. We will be talking about Margaret Sanger, the struggle over women's reproductive rights, and the revisionist attacks of the right wing on Planned Parenthood. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy is therefore what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow to that end. Many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Dr. Chesler, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Dr. Ellen Chesler is currently a senior fellow at the Four Freedoms Center of the Roosevelt Institute, an innovative New York City-based think tank that promotes ideas, influences policy, and nurtures young talent, all by the way of creating a living legacy for Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, whose presidential library in Hyde Park the Institute also supports. She is shaping the Institute's new policy program on human rights while also helping to expand overall public programming. For nearly 10 years prior, she served as a senior fellow and a program director at the Open Society Institute, where she helped develop and execute the foundation's global investments in reproductive health and women's rights. She's the author of the critically acclaimed Women of Valor, Margaret Sanger and the Birth Control Movement in America, which was a finalist for the Penn's 1993 Martha Albrand Award of Nonfiction. She's also the co-editor of Where Human Rights Begin, Health, Sexuality, and the Women in the New Millennium. She's written numerous essays and articles for all the national periodicals from the New York Times, the New Republic, the Nation. She's written blogs for the New Deal, the online publication, the Roosevelt Institute, New Deal 2.0. She currently chairs the nominating committee for the board of directors of Planned Parenthood Federation America. She serves on the advisory committee of women's rights. It's so much. It goes on. And of course, she is an honors graduate of Vassar College. She earned her master's and doctoral degrees in history at Columbia University. She's married to New York lawyer Matthew Mallow, and they are the parents of two adult children, like I am, though I'm not married to him. Betty Friedan, who many critics and social scientists cite as the modern progenitor and even possibly the godmother of feminism, wrote about your book, Women of Valor, that it shows us a zesty, authentic heroine who kept on evolving personally and politically as we all must. I found fascinating the lessons for feminists in Margaret Sanger's struggle for reproductive autonomy. Ellen Chesler shows how Sanger transcended both the radical rhetoric and the conventional politics of the day to forge a new day for women. Dr. Chesler, who was Margaret Sanger? What was her role in the advancement of women's rights in the early part of the 20th century?
Well, she was born Margaret Louisa Higgins in 1879, the middle child of a large Irish Catholic family. Her mother, a devout Catholic who died worn out from childbearing at the age of 49. Her father, an apostate buried outside the fence of the church cemetery, which sort of tells you everything you need to know. She trained as a nurse nearby where you're broadcasting from in Westchester, married a young architect and painter named William Sanger, settled actually in Hastings-on-Hudson briefly, but the comforts of bourgeois life at the turn of the century were not for her or him, as it turned out. And they moved back into New York City and became followers of labor organizers, free thinkers, and bohemians of the day. I would say no gods, no masters. The rallying cry of the IWW was her personal and political manifesto.
Wobbly.
For some years, wobbly, right, in around World War I. This was, remember, a time, sort of a halcyon time at the turn of the early part of the 20th century when the country seemed wide open with possibility. Mm-hmm. But what began as a callow faith and revolution quickly gave way to a more concrete agenda for reform. Her husband left his architecture practice. He was Jewish. There was a great deal of discrimination in those days against Jews in architecture. And he began to paint, so she took a job as a visiting nurse on New York's Lower East Side, watched a young patient die tragically from the complications of what were then all too common illegal abortions, and vowed to abandon palliative work and devote herself instead to the single-minded pursuit of reproductive autonomy for women. She staged an arrest, opened a clinic in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn, deliberately went to jail for 30 days, but on appeal, her bold and courageous step wound up with a decision by the New York courts, the appellate courts, that allowed her to license the provision of contraception by physicians. She'd wanted it to be nurses, actually, women, but only with physicians for medical purposes. And under those constraints, she, through the 1920s and 30s, spearheaded a birth control movement which provided clinics with doctors providing women the first medical and reliable contraception that that's ever been provided at the time when there was no public health in America at all, no prevention, no primary care. And this morphed into, in the 1940s, what we know today as the Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
Right. You know, you've had a long, distinguished career in the fight for women's rights here in the United States and all over the world. My wife, who graduated from Barnard College in New York City, believes that a women's college helps shape a woman's sense of self-worth and independence. Did your education at Vassar make you more sensitive to women's issues? And when did you get first involved professionally with this field?
You know, I think it's an interesting question, a fascinating one. I would say that my education, I was the last class of all women at Vassar, which in 1970, after I had graduated, which tells you my age, went co-ed. And I would say that Vassar gave me great confidence as a woman, but did not make me a feminist, because it didn't even occur to me that there was discrimination. I had wonderful, brilliant professors. No men were challenging my authority or my autonomy. In fact, in the classroom, it was more when I got to Columbia and I suddenly realized that this was such a unique set of circumstances. We never studied women's rights or women's history at Vassar. There really wasn't much of that. It was at Columbia as a young graduate student when I suddenly realized that there was a whole part of American history that had never been written, the history of women. And I was really fortunate to be part of that pioneering young generation of women historians who began to write about and think about this lost part of our past. And while we spent some time valorizing women's experience, we then came to understand that the absence of women had really shaped the way we thought about history, and that without a perspective of what women were doing, what women were thinking, we had to reshape our thinking not only about women but about history. The progressive movement, for example, when you see it through the eyes of Jane Addams, is very different than when you see it through the eyes of Teddy Roosevelt.
Right. You know, and bringing up women, of course, I have had a lifetime's interest in Franklin Delano Roosevelt, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt, who Harry Truman called the first lady of the world. Her life and work has been a shining beacon to the civilized world for almost a century. Was she an influence on you, and did her life's work influence you to connect with the Roosevelt Institute?
Well, this is also a wonderfully interesting question. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, went to public schools, and as a young woman was put in a gifted program where we had to get up in the morning, this is in the 1950s, and speak to our classmates about some topic of interest where we also had to do research. And I mean, I think everything about my life was shaped by this extraordinary public education opportunity that I had in this program in Cleveland. And in what I was 9 years old, so it was about 1956, 1957, I gave my first morning talk on Eleanor Roosevelt. Now, why was that? My father was a politician, actually a Republican. He was a lawyer and active in Ohio politics. And the only woman whom I could think of, I was a girl, right, who was political was Eleanor. And, of course, from that moment on, I became devoted to not only her legacy but also her husband's, and have been obviously involved in as a scholar activist in Democratic politics all my life.
And you know, it's interesting, before we go to a break, that the Roosevelt Institute is doing such remarkable work all around the country today. I've been a member for many years, and of course, in the years I've been involved and interested in listening to it, it was always about, you know, the support of the Hyde Park and the remembrances of the Roosevelts and many things like that in awards. But now it's really involved deeply in public policy.
And also leadership development. We have a very robust campus network now with about 12,000 students on more than 100 campuses, public and private, all over the country. And now a very active young pipeline or young professionals program. And I think what this means is that we understood that after so many years of having the Roosevelt legacy beaten down by conservative think tanks, conservative politicians, and also conservatives who were building networks on campuses and among young professionals, the progressive movement had to do more than just historicize its past and valorize its accomplishments. It had to really build new ideas, new thinking, and new talent.
It's
a great privilege for me. I'm an academic by training, but by the time I finished my PhD in the late 70s, there weren't a lot of jobs for historians.
I got involved
in politics and then philanthropy. At this end of my career, it's a really wonderful opportunity to be here writing a new book and doing this kind of work.
And that's a great tribute to the leadership of Bill VanHeuvel. It's been a great leadership. We have to go to a short financial news update in a few seconds. Been talking to my guest and author, historian Ellen Chesler. Been talking about Margaret Sanger, the struggle over women's reproductive rights, and the revisionist attacks of the right wing on Planned Parenthood. We'll be right back in a moment. Thank you.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD2.
From the Fox Business Network, major central banks around the globe took coordinated action to ease the strain on the world's financial system, and that sent stocks soaring. At noon Eastern, the Dow was up 412 points. The U.S. Federal Reserve, European Central Bank, Bank of England, and the central banks of Canada, Japan, and Switzerland are taking steps to make it cheaper for foreign banks to borrow dollars. A ratings downgrade by Standard & Poor's for six major U.S. banks yesterday added to fear that Europe's financial problems would hurt the entire financial system. And Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is buying Buffett's hometown newspaper, Omaha World Herald Company. Despite Buffett's reservations about the newspaper industry, Berkshire Hathaway says it is expanding the firm's newspaper holdings. The terms of the deal were not made public. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Adam Shapiro.
Quality never goes out of style. And the quality of the Paul Frederick White Pinpoint Oxford dress shirt at just $19.95 will make it the staple of your wardrobe. This special introductory offer won't last forever, so act now to get the quality, comfort, and style you can only get from the Paul Frederick White Pinpoint Oxford dress shirt. Order today and receive free monogramming, a $9.75 value. Go to 1995shirt.com and enter promo code POCKET. That's 1995shirt.com, promo code POCKET.
From AM 1460 WVOX.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest author and historian, Dr. Ellen Chesler. We've been talking about Margaret Sanger, the struggle over women's reproductive rights, and the revisionist attacks of the right wing on Planned Parenthood. You know, in the last few months, we've seen a parade of Republican candidates for the presidency trying to outdo themselves with regards to right-wing social and economic positions. One of their most typical targets they harp on is women's reproductive freedom. Many of them couch their attacks from a pro-life position, attacking just the right of choice. But many target any type of reproductive freedom by attacking birth control and specifically groups like Planned Parenthood. Recently, GOP candidate Herman Cain, who has his own problems as of today, labeled Margaret Sanger a racist. Could you give us an answer to that smear?
It couldn't be farther from the truth. Sanger actually held very unusually advanced views on race relations for her day, and on many occasions condemned discrimination and encouraged racial reconciliation. Though most birth control facilities conformed to the segregation mores of the 1930s, she actually opened an integrated clinic in Harlem in the early 1930s with W.E.B. Du Bois, the head of the NAACP, cutting the ribbon on that clinic. Later, she facilitated birth control and maternal health programs for rural black women in the South when local white health officials there denied them any access to any of the, you know, sort of social welfare services provided by the New Deal. She worked on that project with behind-the-scenes support of Eleanor Roosevelt, whose advanced views on race were well-known and quite controversial, and Mary McLeod Bethune, a founder of the National Council for Negro Women, and then a Roosevelt administration official, the only major African-American official. What's ironic, of course, is that while their progressive views on race were well-known, if controversial, their support for birth control was silenced by Franklin's political handlers, who were concerned about the Catholic Church and rural fundamentalist Protestants, who were sort of the backbone of the New Deal coalition, much as they've become the backbone of the Republican Party coalition today. It's so ironic.
You know, you quoted Martin Luther King in 1966 when he accepted Planned Parenthood's prestigious Margaret Sanger Award and spoke eloquently of the kinship between civil rights and family planning movements. He said, "There's a striking kinship between our movement and Margaret Sanger's early efforts. She, like us, saw the horrifying conditions of ghetto life. Like she knew that all society is poisoned by cancerous slums. Like she was a direct advocate, a nonviolent resistant. She launched a movement which is obeying a higher law to preserve human life under humane conditions." So that's not the whole quote, but are we seeing today a conscious effort by GOP candidates to attempt to reverse the progress of women when it comes to reproductive freedom?
Well, I think there's no doubt that this has become a highly partisan issue. It used to be very different. You had, you know, pro-choice and anti-choice people in both parties, but it's become the backbone of what the Republicans feel is their only chance at winning. Let me explain a little bit, which is that Republicans used to be the supporters of women's rights and contraception. Barry Goldwater was a big supporter of Margaret Sanger's.
So was Bush's grandfather. Yeah, mm-hmm. Prescott Bush.
That's right. Prescott Bush's, that's right. The George Bush's grandfather
was a founder.
His wife was the president of Planned Parenthood in Connecticut and active in the effort to get the Supreme Court decision passed that protected access to contraceptive for married Americans. I should always remind people it took another 7 or 8 years to get the unmarried Americans protected. But Griswold, the decision in 1965, was in part because of the Bushes. And George H. Bush, wrote the Title X Family Planning Act in the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. But that is reversed when Reagan's handlers in the 1980s, and there's now quite a bit of literature on this subject, suddenly realized that if they want to win, they have to pick apart the New Deal coalition, and they have to go at people who they think are vulnerable to changing their political identification on two grounds. One is race, so they go for poor whites who are concerned about what is being done for African Americans and minorities in this country, and who believe that they're being left out, and they go for women who they think might be vulnerable on sexuality issues and on abortion, both Catholics and others. And that's how they try to win back a majority, and they succeed briefly. But I would argue today this is a wrong strategy. Recent polling has shown, in response to the war on Planned Parenthood earlier this year in the Congress, that 65% of Americans support Planned Parenthood, 40% of them strongly, and if you control that those numbers and unpack them by race or age or gender, the support for Planned Parenthood runs off the charts. Young people support Planned Parenthood, men and women, 80% to 20. Women support Planned Parenthood, 80% to 20. And African Americans, who are you know, such important users of its services all over the country are particularly loyal to Planned Parenthood. Again, 80 to 20. So there is a small minority of Americans who are very concerned about abortion. And I mean, and one does not want to challenge the moral foundations behind their principles, although I would argue that they misunderstand what abortion is. It's been misrepresented to them. Most abortions take place extremely early in pregnancy and don't involve fetuses and don't have quite the consequences morally that they're, that some of the opponents are trying to present them as having. We're not chopping up fetuses here. And in the instances where, the very few instances where you have to have abortion late, generally there are fetal anomalies or challenges to the health of the mother that are that really demand our support for this choice. Women who have abortions are responsible women who can't afford another child or need for another reason to limit the size of their family. They're not irresponsible.
Right.
But in any event, I think this is a wrong strategy, and needless to say, Herman Cain has other problems.
Right. He's got other problems you'll have to deal with. You know, speaking of this freedom of choice, is this a linchpin to women's rights regarding sexual harassment, birth control?
Nobody said it better than Margaret Sanger. She wrote in a book that was a bestseller in 1920, "No woman can call herself free until she can decide, you know, whether or not she wants to be a mother." And I think this has now become a universal human right. The United Nations has the linchpins of its human rights revolution is a convention on women's liberation or women's freedoms called CEDAW, which positively obligates states to provide voluntary, free, non-coercive family planning to all women who want it. It's not only necessary for women, but it's necessary for the well-being of their families, their communities, and ultimately nations.
Yeah, Ellen, very true. My personal belief, and I don't like to expose them here too much, is that that's a linchpin to all rights for women. And if that goes, everything else will quickly follow. We have to go to a commercial break in a few seconds. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio, 1460 live streaming at WVOX.com. My guest author and historian, Dr. Ellen Chesler, who've been talking about Margaret Sanger, struggle over women's reproductive rights, and the revisionist attacks of the right-wing Planned Parenthood. We'll be back in a moment.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Chris Foster. The Dow way up on Wall Street, 414 points on news that country's central banks will make it easier and cheaper to lend money internationally. Former Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky is now being sued by a man accusing him of childhood sexual abuse, not one of the eight named in criminal charges. Attorney Jeff Anderson reading from a statement.
I never told anybody what he did to me over 100 times at all kinds of places until the newspapers reported he had abused other kids.
The unidentified accuser is also suing Sandusky's charity and Penn State. More senior citizens.
Between 2000 and 2010, the total population 65 years and over increased by 5.3 million people.
That's Kerry Werner with the U.S. Census Bureau. Fox News. We report. You decide.
This is Kevin Gallagher. I've lived in our beloved Westchester County now for 55 years. Most of them right here in the Nurshell, Larchmont, and Mamaroneck area. That's my home turf. And after a long career in banking, I'm very pleased to have begun an exciting new opportunity with the well-known and highly respected Weichert Realtors. During my financial years, I dealt with the great folks at Weichert here in the county and came to have tremendous regard for their skill at buying and selling homes, their integrity, their unique knowledge, and their reputation in the competitive real estate market. So I'm glad to be associated with these nice people. I'm now at the Weichert office on the Post Road in Larchmont these days, and I'd be glad to help you list your home or to find a brand new one. Please give me a call to discuss residential opportunities all over Westchester. 914-833-0800, extension 200. And if a good-looking Irishman answers, that's me, Kevin John Gallagher, Weichert in Larchmont, 833-0800, extension 200.
The most innovative and groundbreaking local transportation service is now here. The Green Team Cab Corporation in New Rochelle. The one and only Green Team Cab Corporation features all new 2011 super luxurious hybrid cars that really make you feel like you're being driven in style and comfort. The Green Team is perfect for all your corporate needs, a trip to the airport, or just a ride anywhere locally. Call Brian Herbie or Mr. O'Mara today at the Green Team Cab Corporation in New Rochelle for a new kind of luxury transportation experience second to none. We love the Green Team and you will too. 914-576-1200 in New Rochelle, 576-1200. Credit cards accepted in the car, no minimums, no forced gratuity. 576-1200, the Green Team, now the most innovative and superior way to travel. The Green Team, saving the planet one ride at a time.
Pelletieri's Eye on Weather is brought to you on WVOX Worldwide by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
Forecast Westchester County in the vicinity for this afternoon, a mixture of clouds and sunshine. Highs will climb into the middle 50s with gusty westerly wind. Partly cloudy this evening, overnight lows falling back into the middle 30s, mostly sunny. Highs will climb close to 50 on Thursday, continued clear at night, lows dropping into the middle 30s, mostly sunny once again on Friday, lower 50s. Looks good for Saturday, bright sunny skies, but cooler weather, middle 40s. More the same for Sunday. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr., reporting for WVUX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
Recently, some people have had questions about the plants that generate our electricity here in New York. You have a right to know the facts about one of the most important providers of power to our area. Did you know that Indian Point provides about a quarter of the electricity for New York City and Westchester, with virtually no emissions and at lower costs? Indian Point's operations are constantly reviewed to ensure safety by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's among the most thoroughly reviewed nuclear energy facilities in the country, and that there are multiple federal inspectors on site, and the law guarantees them access to any document, any employee, and any portion of the facility. That's accountability, every day, all the time. I'm Teresa Motko, and I'm an engineer here at Indian Point, and my family and I live in the area. All of us have a right to know why Indian Point is right for New York. Visit rightfornewyork.com for answers.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of school superintendent Richard Organishak, Lou Felicione, Bob Lebensold, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
Merry Christmas!
From our family to yours.
AM 1460 WVOX.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest author and historian, Dr. Ellen Chesler. We've been talking about Margaret Sanger, the struggle over women's reproductive rights, the revisionist attacks of the right wing on Planned Parenthood. You know, in Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville argued that the ending of the laws of primogeniture and entail regarding the inheritance of private property resulted in a more rapid division and breakup of the land. This, therefore, forced the propertied classes to seek sources of wealth beyond the narrowness of their family estates in order to maintain their previous standards of living. By this breakup or subdivision of wealth, an acceleration regarding the decline of the landed aristocracy caused a more rapid shift to democracy. Dr. Chesler, in the beginning of the 20th century, 75 years after de Tocqueville's visit, what was generally the democratic, and I say that in quotes, status of women in America?
Well, they did have property rights after a bit of a struggle in the late 19th century. Women were allowed to inherit property. But women didn't have the vote in the United States until 1920. And let's talk about what that meant and why that was. That was because the basic status women enjoyed as citizens of a democracy in this country was assumed to be through men. They were the doctrine of coverture, as it was called, defined their citizenship, that their rights as citizens were covered by their fathers or brothers or husbands. And that's what underscored the opposition to suffrage for women, the idea that somehow women would have a vote in their own right. And the hardest thing about writing about Margaret Sanger or this period for modern audiences is to make people understand that women were, identity was as mothers, wives and mothers. And there were a generation of suffragists and social welfare activists who had come of age at the 20th century, the first educated women. Remember, you don't have higher education for women until the late 19th century. But they were intended to forego marriage in order to gain professional stature or public influence. Sanger's heresy wasn't saying that women should have it all. They should be able to balance work and family obligations. And for our generation, these are routine claims, but what she was saying in her own time was incredibly destabilizing. People really were threatened by this idea. Ultimately, women get the vote in 1920, in fact, not because everybody sees it as a natural right or that women should have it of their own, but because there's a discourse that develops in part about government and the government's need to sort of attend to some of the roles that families had traditionally assumed or churches had traditionally assumed, like public health and education and the socialization of children. And so an argument was made by the suffragists that, well, then women need to be citizens and part of the government because the government's doing kind of womanly things. And there's also, of course, the equal rights argument. But it's really hard to imagine. You know, we talk about this in Afghanistan today or the Muslim world, but it's only 100 years that women have had rights in the United States.
Right. You know, Margaret Sanger coined both terms, birth control and subsequently family planning. Why'd she change the term to family planning?
Because birth control was seen as feminist and individualistic, and along comes the Depression, a time of where there's a great need for social cohesion and not for individual rights, and also a kind of enchantment once you get Roosevelt there with the idea of social and economic planning. And Sanger is kind of a brilliant publicist and organizer, and so she basically attaches herself to the enthusiasm for planning in that era and comes up with the term family planning. She kind of ultimately, as she grows older, resents it a bit because she feels that it's lost some of its feminist punch.
You know, after the collapse of the old order, as Arthur Schlesinger termed the end of the Hoover era and the emergence of the New Deal, Margaret Sanger, who enjoyed the support and friendship of both Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, expected full legalization of contraception. What happened and what were the political pressures that faced the New Dealers?
Well, two things happened. The New Deal coalition, as I said earlier in the program, is founded on a kind of coalition of northern urban Catholics and southern white fundamentalist Protestants, and both of them are the holdouts among religions to and most resistant to the changes that are occurring in women's status and to the idea of government intervention in family life. You can look at the whole 20th century in a way, and I would say that my book did this, and that was its part of its critical success, as a contest for control over the lives of individuals. The churches have traditionally been the arbiters of moral values for people. They've, you know, that's where charity also took place. The church took care of the breadbasket, poverty. You know, if somebody fell on hard times, the church responded. The progressive churches came to understand that government had a incredible role in both those things. The Catholic Church was a holdout, and in the 1930s, when Roosevelt put forward Social Security, the Catholic Church actually opposed it, and he did a big deal with them to say, well, look, and we have a kind of odd social welfare system in this country because of it. We will take responsibility for the costs of social welfare, for that breadbasket, for the programs for, you know, children in foster care or elderly or mothers with dependent children, but we'll actually contract with you to deliver the program. So we actually have one of the only social welfare systems in the developed world where government doesn't provide direct services. It often contracts either with non-governmental institutions that are non-sectarian or with churches, Protestant.
Yeah, I think also
Jewish and Catholic.
I think also there were a lot of people who wanted large populations, large labor forces, felt this would restrict the growth of population. We had all sorts of dynamics. You know, in the 1920s, the concept of eugenics became connected to Darwinism, birth control, and what Sanger called the cradle competition of class and race or ethnicity. Did all these controversial intellectual and social arguments and goals cloud the movement for women's productive rights? We only have a minute or so.
Sanger was a eugenicist, as were just about every progressive thinker, university presidents, all the social scientists, of 9 judges on the Supreme Court that ruled in a controversial decision called Buck v. Bell in 1927. She was, like a lot of people in her era, took away from sort of the idea of Charles Darwin, the optimistic lesson that our evolution from the animal kingdom makes us all capable of improvement if only we apply the right tools. She was a person who believed that medicine and science should, should improve people's lives. As a nurse, she understood the adverse impacts of poor nutrition, drugs, alcohol on fetal development, and encouraged support of maternal and infant health for that reason, that there was no bright line, in her view, between biology and destiny, or biology and environmental interventions. That we had to be concerned about compromises to people's well-being from bad health care and from bad genes. It's unfathomable today to think that people believed in this, but they did in the 1920s. It was a pervasive kind of part of American progressive thinking. Her emphasis was on voluntary use of birth control, which many eugenicists opposed because the middle class, they wanted to have more babies. And as you just said, she countered by disdaining what she called the cradle competition of class, race, or ethnicity. She opposed immigration restrictions, and which some eugenicists supported. She framed poverty as a matter of differential access to resources like birth control.
We got to go to a short break. Ellen, you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming on WVOX. My guest, author and historian Ellen Chessa. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
With world and national news 3 times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. Another alleged victim comes forward in the Penn State sex abuse scandal. The man explaining he's taking action now because...
I don't want other kids to be hurt and abused by Jerry Sandusky or anybody like Penn State to allow people like him to do it, rape kids.
That's attorney Jeff Anderson reading a statement from the 29-year-old who says that the ex-assistant football coach abused him more than 100 times, beginning when he was 10 years old. The president in Pennsylvania presses case for a bigger temporary payroll tax cut, while many of the GOP candidates who hope to replace him are in New Hampshire.
Rick Perry, Ron Paul, and John Huntsman all campaign in the Granite State. Meantime, Michelle Bachmann setting her hopes on winning Iowa. She's back there today holding a town hall and speaking at a university.
Fox Radio's Jessica Stone Herman came stumping in Ohio. Fox News, we report, you decide.
The Criterion Collection and Janus Films in Hartsdale reminds WVOX listeners that the results of child abuse are devastating. Each year, millions of children are subjected to it, and many die. And for the survivors, the pain inflicted on them as children influences their entire lives. If you or anyone you know needs help, call your local child abuse hotline. This message from the Criterion Collection and Janus Films in Hartsdale.
One of the most important things our local WVOX radio station is known for is to alert and inform our many loyal listeners what schools, churches, temples, meetings, after-school activities will be delayed or canceled when snows and storms arrive. These announcements are the kind of information everyone in Westchester need to hear about right here on 1460 AM. Official, all-important, informative, and informational storm announcements are being made possible through the generosity of premium Nissan at 2533 Palmer Avenue in New Rochelle. Premium Nissan is a superb Nissan dealership, always friendly and welcoming to their customers, helping them get in on really good deals. Because New Rochelle's premium Nissan know that Westchester shoppers deserve the best. And the staff at Premium Nissan only want the best for their customers. Premium Nissan will be informing you as to what is closed on those snowy, wintry days, because Premium Nissan is the official weather storm center for WVOX radio station.
We're looking for the next Mike Francesa, Michael K., Boomer and Carton, or WVOX alum John Bronstein.
WVOX and WVOX Worldwide at WVOX.com now has program time available for rising young sports broadcasters.
And you can now produce or host an hour or half hour for your own sports talk show.
Our David O'Shaughnessy has all the details about special reduced airtime costs for independent sports talk producers.
Call David now to reserve your own weekly time slot and start booking your own guests. 914-636-1460. 914-636-1460 for special prices for sports talk show hosts on WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
Peace on Earth.
That's what I want for Christmas.
Happy Holidays.
From WVOX Worldwide.
Every day for you and yours. 1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates and WVOX Radio 1460 live streaming at WVOX.com. My guest is Dr. Ellen Chesler of the Roosevelt Institute. We've been talking about Margaret Sanger, struggle over women's reproductive rights, revisionist attacks, the right wing on Planned Parenthood. Getting back to the struggle for reproductive rights, and you mentioned this, the landmark Supreme Court ruling in Buck versus Bell authorized compulsory sterilization of a young white woman with an illegitimate child on the ground of feeble-mindedness. And it was never really clearly established this was her condition. This has been cited as an example of Sanger's failure to consider fundamental human rights. What was the climate of those times, and how do you explain Sanger's agreement with an 8-1 majority vote in Buck v. Bell? And, of course, there were progressives who voted in the majority.
In fact, the only one who didn't was the one Catholic on the court at the time. And those progressives included Brandeis and Holmes, right, two of the giants of American legal history. Let me say that I can't completely explain it. Nobody can. But one of the things I did it's just hard to imagine that people wouldn't have been more sensitive to abuse of laws and of interventions medically that might have been well attended, but certainly weren't in people's real interests. This was simply not a time that hewed to the same standards for rights and protection of rights as we do today, and it's a good thing that we've improved our obligation to protect rights.
Yeah, times change, obviously.
Times change, but Sanger herself, while she supported Buck v. Bell and spoke, and that's what's been misrepresented and taken out of context and out of history, about the consequences to a country of too many people of poor intelligence and defective heredity. And those are the quotes that are completely misrepresented in the kind of internet-fed frenzy of anti-choice rhetoric today about her and about Planned Parenthood.
Right.
I mean, there is a reason why this exists and why it's able to be misrepresented. That while she supported that, she spoke mostly in a very positive way about the positive obligation of the state to provide not only voluntary access to family planning, but also a social safety net for people. She was a progressive. She was a New Dealer.
Right. We have a caller. Please identify yourself and express your question.
Yes, it's Mr. Cam from New Rochelle. I don't have questions. I have answers. And I want to make a brief statement. And, of course, I'll ask if your guest agrees. I think we have the same unholy alliance, as it were, between urban Catholics and fundamentalist Protestants now. I understand in France that contraceptives are given out in high school. They have far lower STD rates, lower unplanned pregnancies, lower abortion rates, even though abortion is easily accessible as opposed to this country, and they don't go to church in Europe anywhere, in the northern Europe, in any like the numbers we do. I think it's 7% in the European Union, and it's 60% here. So we're kind of a backwater here culturally. And until we get away from this American Gothic and the old Catholic hierarchy, we're not going to make any progress anywhere on the so-called moral front.
Well, thank you very much for your point. Any connection to you on that, Dr. Chesler?
Well, I simply want to say that I respect Catholics and others who disagree with my points of view, and I fully expect them to therefore respect my right to disagree. And what we only want in America is the right to choose, the freedom of choice in these matters. Nobody's asking anybody to use these services. But as I would say that the most important and really exciting development of our times is that aspect of the Affordable Health Care Act that will provide coverage for contraception for all American women without exceptions. The controversy today is that the Catholic hierarchy, and I wouldn't say this is true of Catholic women, because most of them don't agree with the hierarchy here, but the Catholic hierarchy is trying very hard to lobby the Obama administration to make an exception for many institutions that deal with the health care of Catholic women, so that at least a million or perhaps more women in America would not have this coverage. And this is the public policy battle we now have to engage with. And I encourage anybody listening today to write to their Congress member or to the White House and make sure that no exceptions are allowed to this extraordinarily important provision that will mandate coverage of contraception as primary preventive health care for all women.
Mm. You know, and getting back to Buck v. Bell and other court rulings, you know, obviously times have changed. And since that ruling in 27 in the 60s, the Supreme Court affirmed in Griswold versus Connecticut that contraceptive use was protected under the privacy doctrine. Planned Parenthood clinics became one of the few primary care centers for the poor. Listening to the rhetoric of the right and the Republican challenges today, are American women's right to choice or reproductive freedom under its greatest challenge regarding the last 40 years?
They certainly are. Hundreds and hundreds of constraints on abortion and access to birth control and sex education have been placed on American women at the state level since 1992, when inadvertently, actually, the Supreme Court protected the core of Roe v. Wade but established a different standard. It's called the undue burden standard for its implementation, which sort of opened up the door to this flood of new rules and regulations. It used to be that the first 3 months of pregnancy, you know, the state had no rights to interfere. The decision about whether or not to continue a pregnancy was a decision between a woman and her doctor. But now there are many constraints on that as well. And hundreds of millions of dollars have been poured into these efforts by anti-choice and, you know, right-wing extremist foundations and others who support these issues. I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier. I think this is partially was an effort to, you know, look at where there were some opportunities for the Republican Party to grow its majority among people sensitive to the changing dynamics of families and of women, and to sort of exploit some of the inevitable anxieties that take place in a culture like ours that has experienced so much change, I mean, you know, in the years that we've come of age, with respect to women's rights. But it's not working, and that's the most important thing to remember. Young people overwhelmingly support choice.
Of course. Let me go into quickly, as we're running down in time, you know, the formerly so-called Republican moderate, Mitt Romney, has flip-flopped on this choice issue and has become almost as dogmatically pro-life as Perry and Kane, Bachman, Santorum, etc. Could the fragile pro-choice balance on the Supreme Court be tipped the other way by an election of a Republican and that Republican's ability to...
There's no question. And the reason, and this is what we have to, you know, make people completely aware of, is that even Mitt Romney, who I believe actually is a more progressive guy with respect to social issues, will be captive to the base of his party if he's elected. And when he goes to make a Supreme Court nomination, he will have to capitulate to them just the way George Bush did.
Right.
So that, you know, poor Sandra Day O'Connor retired because she wanted to be with her ailing husband once George Bush was elected, with the full expectation that he would appoint somebody like her. And then he didn't, because he was captive to the base of his party, which has become very conservative. Right. It's not that they're a majority in the country. The majority of this country is fundamentally pro-choice, sensible, and this includes many practicing Catholics and Protestants and Jews, you know, who are Orthodox in other respects in their lives. Mm-hmm. That their views on contraception, particularly, but even abortion, are more moderate.
Ellen, quickly, the vote in Mississippi on personage, is Mississippi one of the more red states in the Union, maybe the reddest state? Was this a good sign for understanding public opinion on this controversial vote?
Extraordinary, a good sign for two reasons. It's the most conservative and most religious state by Gallup's, the polling organization's assessment in the country. But it's also a place where progressive forces, both Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and organized local people, and explained to them why this personage amendment was not in their interest, how extreme it was, and turned around a 31-point polling deficit in 10 days. It is something that we should all pay attention to about the importance of political organization.
I'm running down in time, Dr. Chesler. I want to thank you for joining today. In the last minute or so, how can people find out about your work? I've got less than a minute.
Go to New Deal 2.0 or www.RooseveltInstitute.org. It's all there. Wonderful communications capacity here at the Roosevelt Institute. I'm joined by some brilliant scholars in economics, and we're trying to also now remember that the Roosevelt legacy was not only economic, but also probably its most important global dimension is in human rights.
Thank you. Thank you again, Dr. Chesler, for joining the most informative program.
Pleasure to be with you.
I hope to hear from you in the future very soon about more of these positions. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other Archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access us on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information, all my guests, is posted. All the shows are there archived. Next week, I'll be discussing the revisionist myths of Pearl Harbor with Professor Donald M. Goldstein, the leading authority on Pearl Harbor, co-author of At Dawn We Slept and Pearl Harbor, Final Verdict. Have a great day, and thanks again to Ellen Chesler for making a great program. See you next week. Bye-bye.